Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we have some updates on the presidential race and two Democratic candidates who won't be in the running. Next, we'll have news about two shocking scandals, both involving Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, including allegations of abuse at ICE detention facilities and sex parties involving local ICE agents. Learn about a new law that is letting pension funds slash benefits for many retirees across America, some by up to 60%. Then hear about a possible strike by California State University employees. We'll have news about former House Speaker Dennis Hastert's impending plea over charges that he paid a blackmailer to cover up sexual misconduct, and why that's only the tip of the iceberg in a scandal that an FBI whistleblower says involves a cover-up of officials involved in espionage. Organ donations are up dramatically in California, and you may be surprised to find out why. Also learn about a proposed ballot initiative that could put California's new right to die law on life support. San Diego police shot and killed an armed suspect in San Diego this week, but why were officers' body cameras turned off? In East County, a bleach spill sickened dozens of students and teachers at a Santee school. On Green Scene, hear about a new report that concludes that most utility-scale solar projects are in environmentally damaging locations. The county is warning about a pigeon drop scam targeting seniors as the victims. On Destination East County, hear about some haunting happenings coming up this week, from a production of Stage Fright to a haunted amusement park and Haunt Fest on Main Street. Plus, hear from author David Schmidt, an East County resident, about his new book, Holy Ghost Stories, just in time for Halloween. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Vice President Joe Biden announced Wednesday that he will not run for the presidency, ending months of speculation that he might enter the Democratic primary to challenge frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Biden lost his son, Beau, to cancer earlier this year and said his family needed time for grieving. Now, he concludes, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination. A recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll showed Biden trailing both Clinton and Sanders nationally among Democratic voters. But Biden says he will not be silent, even though he is out of the race. He stated, I intend to speak out clearly and forcefully to influence as much as I can where we stand as a party and where we need to go as a nation. Joined by President Barack Obama as he made the announcement, Biden pledged to support medical research to cure cancer, also calling for strengthening the middle class and making education affordable. Both Clinton and Sanders issued statements praising the vice president. Former Secretary of State Clinton sent a tweet calling Biden a good friend and a great man, adding that she remains inspired by his optimism and commitment to change the world for the better. Senator Sanders issued a statement calling Biden a good friend also and thanking the vice president for a lifetime of public service and for all that he has done for our nation, adding, I look forward to continuing to work with him to address the major crises that we face. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is DeVario Bell. Former Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Jim Webb has announced that he has dropped out of the running to be the next president. Webb acknowledged that there is a disconnect between himself and other Democrats on key issues. According to NBCNews.com, Webb stated, I fully accept that my views on many issues are not compatible with the power structure and the nominating base of the Democratic Party. The former Virginia senator is pro-guns, pro-coal, and pro-nuclear, issues on which his views align more with Republican views than Democratic platform values. He also says he plans to remain a voice in politics. According to NBCNews.com, I'm not going away, he pledged. He also mentioned the possibility of running as an independent. If Webb were to run as an independent, he would have until next summer for the filing deadlines.
A new report titled Lives in Peril, How Ineffective Inspections Make ICE Complicit in Immigration Detention Abuse has been released this week by the National Immigration Justice Center and Detention Watch Network. The report exposes how the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, inspections process for immigration detention centers, quote, obscures and perpetuates widespread abuses of detained immigrants, according to a statement released to media by the two organizations. The report is based on ICE inspections documents for 105 immigration detention facilities and features focused analyses of inspections for detention centers in Arizona, Florida, Alabama, Texas, Georgia, and Illinois. The inspections information was obtained through a federal court order resulting from 3 years of litigation under the Freedom of Information Act. A press release issued by the groups that produced the reports concludes that the documents reveal fundamental inconsistencies in inspection reports, which suggests that the immigration detention inspection process is a sham designed to perpetuate a broken and abusive system. Claudia Valenzuela, director of detention for the National Immigrant Justice Center, says, quote, "The government fought for years to keep these inspection reports hidden from the public eye, and now we know why. Despite its early promises to make the detention system more accountable and humane, the Obama administration has perpetuated a system that ensures detention contractors pass their inspections and continue to receive billions of dollars from taxpayers to detain immigrants, even in jails where there are highly publicized human rights abuse." Unquote. Mary Small, policy director for the Detention Watch Network, adds, quote, "ICE's inspection process is fundamentally broken and fails to adequately assess troubling conditions and human rights violations detained immigrants face. Plain and simple, the Obama administration's attempts at reforming the immigration detention system have failed. Detention centers are not safe, abuses are widespread, and detention facilities consistently fail to meet basic minimum standards," unquote. The report also found the following. ICE has kept the detention inspections process centralized under its own authority and has hidden the system from the eyes of U.S. taxpayers. ICE's inspection regime fails to provide an accurate assessment of the conditions immigrants experience in detention and holds most facilities to weak and outdated human rights standards and often fails to acknowledge publicly reported abuses. Numerous inconsistencies within and between inspection reports raise serious questions about the validity of ICE inspections and imply that the inspection process is designed to facilitate passing ratings so that local governments and private prison companies can maintain their contracts, raising serious questions over ICE policing itself. The report concludes that a robust and legitimate inspection process would find that detention facilities around the country fail to meet basic minimum standards and require ICE to discontinue contracts with facilities that fail to uphold basic human rights protections. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Ed Barena.
This is Leon Thompson from East County Magazine. A federal investigation is underway into allegations claiming that a supervisor at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in downtown San Diego has been recruiting workers for swinger sex parties at his home that he shares with his wife, who is also an ICE agent. The anonymous complaint was filed with Homeland Security's Inspector General. However, the department referred the complaints to ICE for an internal investigation and has questioned several people in the local ICE office, the San Diego Union Tribune reports. The Union Tribune has reviewed the complaint and reports that it contends workers were approached during work and via text messages. The sex parties reportedly included sexual romps, which allegedly occurred in a bedroom while children were at home. The complaint further alleges that some employees felt coerced and intimidated in an office where 13 employees have also filed complaints with the Equal Employment Opportunity Office, alleging that they were harassed, verbally abused, or discriminated against based on race or gender. Workers held a protest outside the agency office downtown last April. Lori Haley, an ICE spokeswoman, said of those complaints, "So far, there have been no findings of discriminatory actions or significant deficiencies in local management practices," the Union Tribune reports. ICE is a federal agency in charge of detaining and deporting undocumented immigrants.
Congress has crumpled the security net for retired union workers. A controversial law passed last December allows multi-employer pension funds to cut benefits if the funds are projected to run out of money. CNN reports that many of these funds, which cover over 10 million workers, are in financial trouble. One of the first to take advantage of this new law is the Central States Pension Fund, which has been teetering on insolvency and now wants to cut benefits up to 60% for retirees who are dependent on its pension payments, if the Treasury Department approves the deal. The fund covers workers and retirees in over 1,500 companies, ranging from truck drivers and construction workers to Disneyland employees. Before the new law, which was pushed through by conservatives in control of Congress, people already retired would have been protected against such cuts. But now it's open season on benefits that they had counted on to take care of them in their golden years. Hardest hit will be workers whose ex-employers have gone bankrupt. The only retirees safe from cuts are those age 80 or older. The average cut is about 28%, Central States Pension Fund has indicated. For retirees suddenly faced with living on half or less of their former pension checks, the future may be grim. Finding work for older Americans is tough in the best of circumstances, and for those facing medical problems in their senior years, the outlook is even more difficult. The Treasury Department has 225 days to approve or reject the pension-cutting plan, which Central States Pension Fund says is needed to prevent it from running out of money in the next 10 years. It blames deregulation of the trucking industry in the 1980s for the loss of 10,000 employees who contributed to the fund in the past. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
California State University professors and other faculty members are voting on whether or not to call a strike at 23 CSU campuses statewide, including San Diego State University and Cal State San Marcos. A union representing the faculty members has asked for a 5% salary raise and more, but the university has only offered 2%, Associated Press reports. Voting began Monday and will continue for 10 days. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. Former House Speaker Dennis Hastert plans to enter a guilty plea to allegations that he paid out blackmail money to keep allegations of sexual misconduct quiet, his attorney told a federal judge, NBC News reports. Hastert is set to appear in court on October 28th and has not formally been charged with sexual crimes, but rather with lying to the FBI about withdrawing $3.5 million from his bank account as hush money payments. The hush money was reportedly paid to stifle reports that Hastert sexually abused students back when he taught high school and wrestling before serving in Congress. He retired in 2007 and later served as a lobbyist for special interests ranging from foreign governments to a tobacco company. But the Hastert scandal runs far deeper than trying to cover up personal sexual misconduct. Sybil Edmonds, an FBI translator, became a whistleblower and subject of a gag order by the FBI over information that she has said she learned while translating official documents involving Hastert and other high-level officials. She has implicated Hastert, his top aides, other congressional members, and government officials in what she calls a criminal network involved in sexual intrigue, blackmail, espionage, and drug running. She has detailed these allegations in books, blog posts at her site, Boiling Frogs Post, and in articles that have been published in other publications, including American Conservative magazine. An article published on October 20th in American Conservative magazine by former CIA officer Philip Giraldi is titled, "Did Foreign Governments Blackmail Denny Hastert?" The article lays out damning details, suggesting that among other criminal actions, Hastert, a Republican, took bribes from the Turkish government to stifle a genocide resolution on Armenia in the U.S. Congress. Giraldi states, Hastert and his lawyers understand that they are well-placed to effectively threaten the government prosecutors because Hastert knows where a lot of bodies are buried, metaphorically speaking. By demanding that the investigative files on him, which could include reports of illegal activity by a broad range of former officials, be released as part of his defense, he can force the government to drop or mitigate the charges against him, the former CIA agent concludes.
If you receive a new heart, lung, kidney, or other donated organ, you may have an undocumented immigrant to thank. Donate Life California, which runs California's organ and tissue registry, reports that the number of organ donors has increased by nearly a third, 30% since a new law took effect in January allowing undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. The Department of Motor Vehicles asked new drivers if they would like to sign up for the Oregon donor list. The surge in new donors came as over 500,000 undocumented immigrants obtained driver's licenses for the first time. Nearly all, 95% of those asked by the DMV agreed to join the Oregon donor list. Still, more donations are needed, however, since more than 23,000 Californians remain on transplant waiting lists. Tracy Bryan, spokesperson for Donate Life California, says that 1 in 3 people on the transplant waiting list die without ever receiving a vitally needed organ, the Sacramento Bee reports. But she adds, the rising number of local and statewide donations provides real hope. For East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
Opponents of California's new aid in dying law, also known as the right to die, have launched a signature gathering effort seeking to put a petition on the ballot to overturn the new law. If their measure qualifies for the ballot by getting signatures from over 365,000 registered voters, the aid in dying law will be put on life support, suspended until voters weigh in. The effort to repeal the law is being led by Stephanie Parker, a patient who suffers from scleroderma, a terminal disease of the connective tissue. She says, those confronting their most difficult days should be treated with compassion, understanding, and support. Our medical response should not be to encourage them to end their lives prematurely. But supporters of the aid in dying law believe that compassionate treatment means giving those suffering pain from terminal illness the right to end their ordeal as painlessly as possible with help from willing physicians. The effort to repeal the new law faces a steep uphill battle, since a recent Gallup poll found that 68% of Americans polled, over two-thirds, said they support allowing a doctor to help end the life of a patient with a terminal illness in severe pain if the patient and the patient's family request the doctor's assistance. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
After Tuesday's shooting of an armed man in the Gaslamp Quarter, the two officers who shot the man are facing controversy for not activating their body cameras, Channel 10 reports. The man fled Horton Plaza around 2 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday afternoon when police tried to stop him after he made a disturbance and interfered with traffic, according to San Diego police. The man ran to 6th Avenue, ignoring orders to stop, according to Captain David Nislight. When he arrived at F Street, the suspect pulled out a pistol and aimed it at police. It was at that point that the officers shot the man, who fell onto the street, then sat up and raised his weapon, goading police to shoot him again. He was taken to UCSD Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. The captain revealed that the officers did not activate their body cameras. Officers are supposed to activate their body cameras prior to all confrontations with citizens. It was not made clear why the officers, a 25-year and 30-year department veteran respectively, did not follow this procedure. The United Against Police Terror San Diego demands transparency from the department. Catherine Mendonca of UAPT told Channel 10, quote, there is no transparency with the body cam footage. Chief Zimmerman has never made any effort to provide any body cam footage, end quote. The suspect was wanted in Virginia for armed robbery. Virginia police warned that he should be considered armed and dangerous, but the officers did not notice at the time of the shooting. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alpert.
A bleach spill at the Cameron YMCA in Santee on Tuesday sent chlorine fumes into nearby Rio Seco Elementary School. 81 people, including 77 staffers and 4 students, were taken to hospitals for treatment of chlorine-based chemical exposure. Those affected complained of a caustic odor, nausea, stinging eyes, and shortness of breath. The Sheriff's Department and County Emergency Services reported some students were kept in classrooms to shelter in place while authorities worked to identify the source of the fumes initially. A portion of Cuyamaca Street was closed down for several hours during the emergency. Classes resumed later in the morning after investigators determined that no further risk existed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report on East County Magazine. Increasingly, San Diegans are drawing power from large desert solar facilities built in Imperial County, with similar facilities slated for the farthest east portions of our county in Boulevard and Hukumba. The projects are being pushed forward to help meet California's ambitious goals to have 40% of electricity from renewables by 2030 under a new law proposed by Governor Jerry Brown. But now a new study by the University of California, Berkeley, finds that reliance on remote solar projects creates environmental problems. Nearly all, 85% of the utility-scale solar energy installations in California have been built in formerly natural environments far away from the urban areas they serve, many near environmentally protected areas or agricultural lands. The study found that 85% of our state's utility-scale solar projects are on sites deemed incompatible by standards of the Carnegie Energy and Environmental Compatibility Model. Stripping bare vast tracts of vegetation actually releases sequestered carbon, adding to greenhouse gas emissions, and can destroy habitat for sensitive species. Moreover, transmitted electricity via high-voltage power lines long distances is inefficient, resulting in significant power loss. Locally, rural residents have also complained about depletion of groundwater resources by construction of the massive sites, as well as fire hazards and loss of rural character. UC Berkeley researcher Rebecca Hernandez led the study. KPBS reports that Hernandez concludes, a compatible solar energy power plant should be sited in places like a commercial warehouse rooftop, over parking lots, or residential houses.
A stretch of Interstate 15 through Poway has been renamed in honor of Tony Gwynn, the former San Diego Padres Hall of Famer who died of cancer in 2007. Signs dedicating a 3-mile section of the freeway to Gwynn, a former Poway resident, went up this week between Scripps Poway Parkway and Camino del Norte. Gwynn spent 20 years with the Padres and later served as head coach at San Diego State University. Gwynn played for the Padres for 20 seasons and was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2007. After his playing career, he became the head coach at his alma mater, San Diego State University. His son, Tony Gwynn Jr., also a professional baseball player, was on hand for the dedication, Times of San Diego reports. He stated, "It brings back memories of me and my dad going to the baseball field and coming back home." The city of Poway is also considering building a monument at Lake Poway Park to honor Gwynn's enduring legacy. For East County Magazine, on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
What are you most afraid of? If you really want to terrify others this Halloween season, forget about ghost and zombie costumes. The thing that strikes fear into the hearts of more Americans than anything may just surprise you. Over half of Americans surveyed say that they're more afraid of corruption of government officials than terrorist attacks, violent crime, snakes, natural disasters, or any other scary thing. That's according to the Survey of American Fears, conducted by Chapman University in California. The survey found 58% of those surveyed are more afraid of government corruption than anything else. Other fears that scored high on the list included cyber terrorism, terrorist attacks, and tracking of personal information by governments and corporations, all listed by 41-45% of those surveyed. Over 39% said they fear economic collapse, and 37% are worried about running out of money. While the survey also did ask about fears of non-political things ranging from reptiles to public speaking, the very real fears cited by most people surveyed may provide insights into why many voters in both political parties seem to be rallying behind non-establishment candidates, not partisan insiders. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
County officials are alerting the public about a group of scam artists known to be targeting elderly residents in the county, particularly seniors in the Hispanic community. The pigeon drop scam is a confidence trick where the victim is persuaded to give up money to secure a larger sum of money from supposed lottery winnings. There are many variations of this scam, but recent cases usually involve three suspects: a Hispanic woman in her 50s, a Hispanic man in his 30s, and a third suspect who only interacts with the victims over the phone. The suspects approach victims in public areas such as trolley stations or shopping malls or a laundromat. They tell their victims, often in Spanish, that one of the suspects has won the lottery but needs help to collect their winnings. One suspect calls another scam artist posing as a lottery official who says on the phone that good faith money is needed in order to receive the winnings. The suspects promise to share a portion of their lottery winnings with the victim. If you are approached by someone claiming to have won the lottery or that a large amount of money was found and you are offered part of the earnings in exchange for good faith money or valuables, here's what to do. Don't pay for found money. Don't be persuaded to go to the bank to withdraw money. Don't take them to your home. Tell them you're not interested and walk away. Victims who have lost money from a scam should call law enforcement or the county's elderly abuse reporting line at 800-510-2020. Earlier this year, District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis, along with County Supervisor Diane Jacobs and County Health and Human Services directors, rolled out an outreach campaign including TV spots and a senior scam stopper toolkit aimed at educating San Diego older residents and their families about how they can protect themselves from financial scams online, over the phone, and in the mail. District Attorney Dumanis states, "Sadly, seniors too often fall prey to heartless scam artists looking to make a fast buck. Our elderly population can be too trusting, and by the time they tell someone something's wrong, their money is long gone." The Don't Get Hooked toolkit is now available in Spanish with examples of additional scams targeting the Hispanic community, such as the pigeon drop scam and immigration scams, along with tips and local resources to help avoid becoming a victim. You can get a free copy at the District Attorney's Office in San Diego or Chula Vista. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes the 50th annual Borrego Days Desert Festival, Haunt Fest on Main Street, a trick-or-treat dog show, Lamplighters Theater production of Stage Fright, and a melodrama in Julian.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including a Marshall Scary Scotty's Haunted Amusement Park Trail, the DM guitar duo in concert, and much, much more.
If you're listening on Friday night, there is still time to head on out to Haunt Fest on Main in downtown El Cajon from 5 to 10 p.m. The admission is free, but some rides will charge a nominal fee. This family-friendly Halloween-themed event features live bands, a haunted car show, a variety of local vendors, and food available for purchase. You can visit the special children's craft and game booths, face painting, outdoor movies, and enjoy carnival rides. You can also dress in your favorite costume and enter the costume contest for a chance to win prizes. You can learn more at hauntfest.org.
The 50th annual Borrego Days Desert Festival will be held October 23rd through 25th. This year's theme is Those Were the Days. Borrego Days Desert Festival has a long history of welcoming in the desert's peak season, enticing locals to come together after a long, hot summer, and to welcome snowbirds back for a warm desert winter. On Saturday, festival goers will line the main street for the popular parade that includes a flyover, equestrians, marching bands, floats, clowns, dancers, and more. There will also be live entertainment, arts and crafts, food vendors, a beer and beverage garden, carnival fun zone with inflatable water slides, obstacle course, bull ride, and more. For details, you can go to BorregoDays.com.
The Julian Triangle Club's 59th Annual October Melodrama, Keeping the Doctor Away, or Take Two Apples and See Me in the Morning, continues this weekend, October 23rd through 25th, at the historic Julian Town Hall. This year's director, Sandy Bennett, is cracking the whip over the all-volunteer local cast who come from all walks of life to put on the traditional melodrama and raise money for local charities and student scholarships. There's always trouble when the villain comes in on the stagecoach, and this year is no exception. Will the miners catch on to his dastardly, conniving plan to steal their gold? Will the sweet heroine be duped by him, and will the handsome sheriff get there in time to save the day? To find out the answers to these and more questions, you can join in the booing and cheering audience participation and see a variety of Olio performances and sing-alongs between acts. For tickets and more information, you can visit julianmelodrama.com.
Madarath Powell Productions brings to the stage the official evening-length premiere of another San Diego-based dance company, Bottled Light Dance Theater. A contemporary dance company presents Kaleidoscope at the Kwai Sun Studios on Center Drive in La Mesa, October 23rd through 24th at 8 p.m. Kaleidoscope is defined as beautiful shapes continually changing patterns and colors. Kaleidoscope is a performance capturing glimpses of real human experiences spanning from mourning to joy. For more information or tickets, contact visionarydancetheater.org.
The Alpine Stagecoach Lions Club is holding a trick-or-treat dog show on Saturday, October 24th at Summers Pass Farms in Flint Springs. The dog show runs from 1 to 4 p.m. with a costume contest for pets, prizes and trophies, food and fun. Plus, you can visit the pumpkin patch to pick out your jack-o'-lantern. All proceeds from this event go directly to purchase a Seeing Eye service dog for someone in need. For details, you can visit alpinelions.org.
The El Cajon Valley host Lions Club will hold its 25th annual pancake breakfast on October 25th from 8 a.m. to noon at the Ronald Reagan Community Center in El Cajon. The event includes live bluegrass music by the Shirt House Band. All proceeds from this event will go towards free eye testing and free glasses for the needy children in East County.
Trunk or Treat in downtown El Cajon takes place on October 28th from 5 to 8 p.m. on Main Street at Magnolia and in Prescott Promenade Park. Classic cars, hot rods, and motorcycles will be decorated with haunting themes as they compete to win trophies for the best decorations. Guests are invited to dress up, too, for the occasion, and candy for trick-or-treaters will also be on hand. You can learn more at downtownec.com.
East County's only haunted trail debuts this Halloween season at the abandoned Marshall Scotty's Amusement Park in El Cajon. Rumored to be haunted by past park employees, Marshall Scary Scotty's Scare Trail will be open from October 28th through the 31st from 6 until 11 p.m. This year, see the bumper car carnage. Try to stay in one piece through the slaughter trail and the haunted park offices. Visit the frightening Ferris wheel and don't forget to brace yourself as you walk through the remains of the Death Coaster. For the chilling details, you can visit MarshallScaryScotties.com. Now for a preview of coming events.
The Grossmont Guitar Guild will present the ODM Guitar Duo in a Tour of Italy concert on November 6th at 7 p.m. The concert will be held in the Cuyamaca College Performing Arts Theater.
Moxie Theater will present The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence. Opening November 8th and running through December 4th, the play tells the tale of four companions in a time-jumping tribute. Watson, the trusty sidekick to Sherlock Holmes, a loyal engineer who built Alexander Graham Bell's first telephone, an unstoppable supercomputer that became the reigning Jeopardy champ, and an amiable techno-dweeb who is looking for love. For tickets and details, contact moxietheater.com.
The Ramona Concert Association presents the Robert Bonfiglio Harmonica Trio on November 14th. Bonfiglio regularly performs with the world's top orchestras and symphonies, including the Boston Pops and the National Symphony at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Called the Paganini of the Harmonica by the L.A. Times, Bonfiglio dazzles audiences worldwide with his constant reinvention of the harmonica. The concert will be held at the Ramona Performing Arts Center on the campus of Olive Pierce Middle School in Ramona on November 14th at 7:30 p.m. For tickets and details on this and other upcoming concerts this season, you can visit RamonaConcerts.com.
The Circle Players of El Cajon will be performing Wrangle at Red Mountain Ranch November 13th and 14th at 7 p.m. and November 15th at 2 p.m. This mystery dinner theater is set at a dude ranch, and attendees are encouraged to wear their Western attire and have a rip-roaring good time. Performances will be held at Richardson Hall in El Cajon. All tickets include a barbecue meal. For reservations or information, contact thecircleplayers at gmail.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like to add to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with David J. Schmidt. He is an East County author of the new book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College. My guest is also the author of two humorous romance parody novels, Pirates of the Danube and The Baron Rides Again. And he has also co-authored The Daily Book of Art and The Daily Book of Photography. Welcome, David. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your new book. I understand that it's a paranormal story taking place in San Diego, which is perfect for Southern Californian Halloween. And your book describes Point Loma Nazarene University as filled with poltergeists and apparitions. Tell us what's haunting this local university and why we should take these stories seriously.
That's right. Well, it's my book is a collection of nonfiction stories, almost all of them firsthand accounts that I've collected from people who have worked at Point Loma, who've studied there. And it's a collection of all these stories involving ghosts, poltergeists, strange things happening. Mm-hmm. As far as who's haunting Point Loma, the easiest answer to say is Madame Tingley. Now, Madame Tingley, Catherine Tingley was her name. She built the campus more than 100 years ago. She was in charge of the Theosophical Society, and they were a group of occultists. They believed in combining the ancient traditions of different religions from around the world. They believed in searching for ancient mysteries. Mm-hmm. And according to some rumors, Madame Tingley was into some darker stuff, too.
Ah.
According to some of the stories, they say she used to hold seances at what is now the campus of Point Loma Nazarene, back when it was housed the Theosophical community. They say that she would sit in her house with people, sit around a table, call up the spirits. Newspapers from the time, they describe her as a spirit medium and a fine trance reader. And most of the stories center around what used to be her house. Now, that building is now called Cabrillo Hall. It's mm-hmm. on the campus. It's used for classrooms, and it houses offices. But back in the day, that was Madame Tingley's house. And Cabrillo Hall, it's built with a very unique architecture. In fact, when you walk inside, you look, and the stairs are very tiny on Madame Tingley's house, Cabrillo Hall. It has very tiny steps on the staircase going to the second floor. According to rumor, the reason for that is that she wanted to be reincarnated as a cat or a turtle, and she wanted to come back and haunt her own house as ghost cat or ghost turtle. And now, obviously, a turtle's not the scariest thing in the world, but many students and security guards are afraid to go in there at night, get a weird feeling in there at night. And I've collected stories from students going all the way back to the 1970s and 80s. One student was in there working with classmates late at night when they heard a moaning coming from a closet door that was locked. Another group of students were in there late at night when they saw banging on the windows, heard the windows being banged on, saw the windows vibrating, but nobody was anywhere nearby. And so most stories center around Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's house. But many of the stories center around places that don't have that much history behind them either. Some of the dorm rooms, the theater on campus, which are newer buildings, they have stories associated with them as well. As for the question of why to take these stories seriously, the simplest answer is that the sources are reliable. The people I've talked to, most of them are very skeptical-minded people, mm-hmm. skeptically-minded people. Some of them grew up and went on to become police officers, military personnel, the type of really analytical right-brained thinker type folks who you would not think of as either superstitious or suggestible in any way.
Interesting. So without spoiling anything, could you tell us why, maybe? Did you get any sense of why she is haunting this place?
Well, a lot of the stories go back to the Theosophists and their history on campus. As far as why this campus in particular and why does it accumulate this kind of activity,
right?
I believe that that's a mystery. I don't think anyone understands something like a haunting. And that's what makes my perspective unique from a lot of other folks who write about ghosts. In general, when you talk about ghosts, I divide most folks out there into two categories. There's two extreme ends of the spectrum. So one end is what I call the Scooby-Doo approach, and at the other end, it's the Ghostbusters approach. So the Scooby-Doo approach is people who say, flat out, there cannot be such a thing as ghosts or hauntings or anything of what we would call paranormal. And you know how that's how every episode of Scooby-Doo ends. They get to the end and it turns out it was a prank the whole time, or, you know, what they thought was a ghost, it was just a sheet hung over a chair, and they say, oh, it was old man Spunkers from the abandoned amusement park the whole time. Right. And I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you kids. And so a lot of people think that way. They think that our science and our understanding of the universe, it's already absolute and it's perfect and we understand how things work. So anything that falls outside of our understanding, it must be superstition or misunderstanding or someone's imagination. Now, the Ghostbusters approach, that's like a lot of these professional ghost hunters you see on TV with their equipment. And that's the belief that ghosts exist and that we understand how they work, that we know what they're made of, that we can detect them, we can record them with our devices. And I don't know if that's totally accurate either. Because if ghosts are real, and I believe that they are in some sense, they're a mystery. I mean, that's why we call it paranormal in the first place. If we understood how it worked, we wouldn't call it paranormal. It would just be normal activity if we understood what they were made of, how to record them.
Right. So what is your critical approach to analyzing the whole topic?
Well, this book is for people who are not really sure what they think about ghosts.
Okay.
It's for a lot of those folks who are in that middle ground who
don't
be me. who don't fall into either the Scooby-Doo approach or the Ghostbusters approach. For people like myself, I'd put myself in that category. People who believe in the possibility of a haunting happening, of something from the past remaining in a place, but don't claim to understand how that works. And I think that's the healthiest approach to go from.
I see.
I think it's silly to assume that our science has already discovered everything there is to be discovered. But I think it's equally silly to assume that ghosts are something we can study and understand with our technology in the status it's in right now. And we just think about technology and science and where it was 100 years ago, 300 years ago, all the things that science had no idea even existed.
Sure.
And so in my book, I look at these stories. I do take them seriously. Because I believe the people who've told them to me, they're very trustworthy sources, without claiming to have a bottom line understanding of what exactly is going on or why these things are happening. But with that being said, I go through a lot of different theories. I go through a lot of critical approaches and theories to hauntings and to ghosts, based on my research and what I've looked into about how we might understand this phenomenon that essentially is a mystery to us humans at this time. One of those theories has to do with quantum theory, the idea that the past and the present are next to each other, are parallel in parallel dimensions, and sometimes those dimensions bleed into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we might see glimpses of the past, catch a figure, a sound from a past moment that has bled over into the present. Another theory is as far as poltergeist activity. A lot of researchers believe that that's not because of something from the past at all, but it's because of a present human being who is undergoing emotional stress, and that stress finds an outlet in what we call telekinetic ability. Now, telekinesis, it's a theoretical idea. Nobody's proven that it exists. There are some scientific experiments that I cite in the book that I looked into that show mild evidence that it might exist. But the theory is that some people have telekinetic abilities, but they unconsciously use them. So they make objects move around. The movie Carrie is the most extreme case of that. You know, the main character, she can cause cars to explode, which would be great if you're getting bullied at school. Unfortunately, nobody's figured out how to control it that way.
Right.
And which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
But that theory is that poltergeist activity is caused by a human, not by a ghost or spirit from the past. And another theory is that the past has a way of imprinting onto certain places. Especially when there's strong emotions involved, those moments from the past that can be very traumatic or emotional, they stick to a place. They imprint on that place through a process that we don't understand, but might be very similar to photographic technology, to audio mm-hmm. recording. And that theory says that certain buildings hold on to moments of the past and continue to replay them on loop that some people, for whatever reason,
that's an interesting theory,
can tap into.
Yeah. So maybe it's a way to connect us with the past so that it's part of our actual experience today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, one researcher, Peter Underwood, he's from Great Britain. He writes about ghosts a great deal. He suggests that by observing ghosts and hauntings, we recharge that recording. So if nobody was there to watch it, mm-hmm. according to his theory, it might eventually fade away and disappear, almost like an old cassette tape that with mm-hmm. time it deteriorates and falls apart. But he suggests that by observing, we feed into it and we recharge those memories that the place holds onto.
Now, you got your BA from Point Loma Nazarene. So did you ever catch hint of any of these happenings or ghosts?
Yeah, I've had a few experiences there. Nothing as dramatic as looking Madame Tingley in the eye, although I did do that eventually in a more abstract sense. At the end of my book, I talk about meeting modern day theosophists and meeting the modern day equivalent of the community that used to be at Point Loma. But I never saw her ghost. I did have some experiences though. I took my cousin and some friends of hers to visit the campus after I had graduated, and they wanted to do some ghost hunting. So we went, I told them the stories behind the places, mm-hmm. and we got to the theater eventually, which has a story about the ghost lamp and about the ghost Irving in there who makes the lamp explode when somebody mocks the ghost. So we went to the theater. They wanted to see the inside, but it was really late. We tried the front doors. They were locked. We went to try one side entrance. As soon as we walked around the side, the light overhead us turned off, and it's not a motion sensor light. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's odd, but it's probably a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
We went around to the other side where there's some wooden steps leading up to a side entrance. And I said, let me try this door. You know, maybe it's unlocked. I went up to check the door, and I tried it. It was locked. So I turned back and I told my cousin, okay, I guess it's time for us to go. And right as I said that, I heard the doorknob jiggle, go back and forth.
Really?
And I booked it down those steps and I ran off, and my cousin made fun of me and called me a coward. But then she showed me that she had taken a picture of me right before that happened, standing on the steps to that side entrance. And in the picture, you see this faint little white glowing orb or ball of light behind me with almost a trail like it's coming up behind me. And I don't put too much stock in ghost photography and orbs, uh-huh. but the weird thing is that that photo was taken right before the doorknob jiggled.
Wow. Did she hear the doorknob jiggle?
Oh, we saw it jiggle. All three of us, me and her friend, all three of us saw the doorknob move back and forth physically.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that nobody was inside the theater at the time. And plenty of my fellow students, classmates also, and people who worked at the college, they all told me these stories when I was a student there. And that was where the idea for this book came from, because I started realizing that this is one unique place that has this huge accumulation of ghost stories about it. And it seemed anybody who spent enough time there eventually had some strange experience that they'd gone through. And as I mentioned, even really critically minded, skeptical people – like my brother, he went on to be a military man and a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
At the time when he was a student, he was a public safety officer, a security guard, and he went into Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's old house. He went in there for the first time. He had heard the stories. He had heard from other security officers that they got weird feelings being in there, didn't like being in that building alone at night. And so he was kind of excited. He went in there for the first time when he had to do building checks. And he's in the building, and he suddenly hears this music, really faint minor key violin music playing. Well, he figured it's probably a radio somewhere. So he decided he'd try to figure out where the music was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
He moved over to different sides of the building. Everywhere he was, it seemed like the music was all around him. Next, he figured, well, somebody left a radio on. They left their computer playing music. So he checked all the radios on both floors of the building. Everything's turned off. All the appliances are unplugged. So then he went down to the basement to check down there.
Never go down to the basement.
Yeah, that's horror movie 101. Never go down
to
the basement. But he goes down. Nowadays, the basement has some art classrooms in it, some art studios. Mm-hmm. So he goes down in there, and it's creepy, and he's all alone with these linoleum floors, and there are these mannequins lying around that look like dead bodies in the dark light. And so he's creeped out, but he checks the basement. And finally, he goes into one of these art studios, And he finds this big stereo sitting in the middle of the studio. He thinks, oh, man, I found it. So he walks up to the stereo and he starts to laugh to himself. Like, I was freaked out. I was afraid of nothing. And there's this stereo here. And he walks over to get a closer look. And then he sees that it's unplugged and the battery cover's hanging open. There's no batteries and it's not turned on. And he can still hear that music.
And it was coming from the radio.
It was not coming from the radio. It was all around him.
Okay. Well, this makes me want to go to the university and check it out myself.
Right.
Now, is Point Loma Nazarene University, is that on the ghost tour of San Diego, you know, the 100 most haunted places?
Right. No, it's not part of that. And in fact, this is the first book that's ever been written about Point Loma Nazarene's ghosts. None of the books, there are several books out there about San Diego's ghosts. Most of them focus on Old Town. They focus on the Hotel Del and some of the other more famous haunted places. But Point Loma's not in any of those books.
Wow.
It's one of the lesser-known haunted spots.
Well, maybe the ghosts like that better.
I suppose. Maybe they like the solitude.
Now, David, I know that you're very well-traveled also. You speak multiple languages, 9?
Right.
You speak 9 officially. Languages. And how is traveling to so many countries and hearing stories from around the world, I mean, how has that piqued your interest in the paranormal?
Well, if anything, it's convinced me that there's more out there that we don't understand than what we do understand. The more countries I've been to, and I've visited a lot of countries, have lived abroad. I currently spend about half the year in Mexico and half the year here in San Diego. I lived in Russia for a while. And if that's taught me anything, it's taught me how much mystery there is, how little of the world we really understand. A lot of us have this hubris about us, and we claim to understand how the world works. And again, that Scooby-Doo mentality of wanting to subject everything to our perception of the natural world, how we perceive it works. And the more you travel and the more you talk to people from different cultures, the more you realize that that's just one worldview. It's one cultural viewpoint out of many that are out there. Now, a lot of people, skeptical people, would say anything that sounds strange or paranormal or ghostly, it must just be superstition. It's because somebody was raised with these beliefs and they're going to see what they expect to see. Now, I think that can definitely happen. And I've met people who are superstitious and who are suggestible, and they're not the type of people that I usually cite in the stories that I collect and write about, because I don't think they are reliable sources. But I've met the opposite also. I think that it's possible to be suggestible and to be predisposed to see something if you are superstitious and believe in it. But I think it's equally possible to be predisposed to not see something if you have this prejudice that that thing does not exist. If you follow a strict prejudice that only the natural world, as I understand it, exists, well, that can blind you to things that may be there the whole time that you may not want to see or not be prepared to see.
Very interesting. Food for thought there. So in honor of Halloween, what is the creepiest brief tale that you can tell us right now? Is there one that you can tell us?
Well, one of my favorite is from Point Loma. It involves a security guard back in the 1970s. And it involves Madame Tingley's house, which the campus you can visit, just ask for a visitor's pass at the guard shack and you can visit the campus and see her house for yourself. It's this old two-story white Victorian style house. So this security guard, he's checking the house out one night, and they say this happened back in the 1970s. This was back when the house was located at a different part of campus. And in the 1980s, they dismantled the house and relocated it to the place where it stands today. But back then, it was located where the music building is. Cooper Music is located now. So he's walking through the house at night alone, and he's feeling a little creeped out. He's walking, he's checking the whole place to make sure that nobody's in there, make sure everything is in its place. He walks up those tiny steps that Madame Tingley had built for herself. And he's on the second story. He's up there and he hears a woman scream. And he thinks, oh my gosh, somebody's in trouble. Somebody needs help. So he calls out, who's there? Can I help you? And he runs down the steps and he thinks somebody's hurt. So he's asking, who's there? Who's there? Hello. And nobody's answering him. He checks every room on the first floor. It's silent. Nobody's in there. He checks the room underneath where he was when he heard this voice screaming. Nobody's in there. The carpet's been freshly vacuumed. There's no footprints in it. And he's thinking, what the heck is going on? He's about to leave, and he turns to leave, and then he hears the voice screaming, and she's still coming from underneath his feet. And he thinks, somebody's in the basement. Somebody's trapped down
there. The basement.
So he's got to go to the basement. Again, never go to the basement.
Never go.
And so he walks out the front doors to the building, and he walks around to the side steps, the stone staircase leading down to the basement. He pulls out his key ring, and he finds that one old skeleton key that opens up the basement. And he has to sort of shoulder the door open, just like those cops in the movies do. And he turns on his flashlight. The basement's silent. It's all still. He's shining his beam around, and there's cobwebs and dust, and there's just a bunch of old tools, boxes stored down there. Back then, nobody ever went down there. They didn't have art studios down there back then. So he's walking through the basement. He's jumping as he sees the shadows, and he thinks he sees monsters and ghosts, but it's just tools and boxes. Nobody's down there at all. He sees the dust on the floor. There's no footprints. So he turns to leave. He figures, well, whatever. Who knows? I don't know why I heard that. Turns off his flashlight, turns toward the door, and then he hears the voice screaming again, and it's still coming from underneath his feet. Now he's in the basement. There's nothing under the basement. So he just runs. He drops his flashlight. It shatters. He runs out. He runs back to public safety headquarters. And nobody believes him. They all make fun of him. They tell him he's going crazy. And they poke fun of him for months after that. And then they forget about it. And they forget this story until a couple of years later when they dismantled the building and they moved it across campus to where it stands today. So they took it apart piece by piece all the way down to the basement. When they got to the wooden floorboards of the basement, as the story goes, they pulled up those wooden floorboards. They find a human skull lying in the earth underneath the basement.
Wow.
Lying face up with its mouth open like it was screaming for all eternity.
And it was a woman.
And according to the story, it was a woman. Now, again, that's how the story goes. But did it actually happen? Well, to find that out, you're going to have to read my book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College.
Well, that's great. You're quite the storyteller. One last question before I let you go. What are you working on next? Will it be more scary stories or something else?
Absolutely. I have a whole series of scary stories I'm working on right now. It's the Tiny Staircase series, named after Madame Tingley's staircase in Cabrillo Hall. This is a series of short ebooks that I'm putting out on Amazon. They're all available on Amazon and on my website, which is holyghoststories.com. Holyghoststories.com is my website. And you can find the newest installations in the Tiny Staircase series on the website. If you go there, you can also find out how to get a free ebook, one of the books in the Tiny Staircase series, which is called Ghosts Recordings from the Past, which goes into that theory of the past imprinting on places. So over the next few months in the future, I'll be releasing more and more installments in that series, the Tiny Staircase series. I'm also working on a book about my search for the little people legends in Mexico, the little people known as the Duendes or the Chaneques in Mexico. This book will be Into the Chaneques Cave, and it will tell the story of my going into a cave where they say these mysterious, legendary little people live in the mountains of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. And so that book will be coming out sometime next year, Into the Chaneques Cave.
Great.
And then more and more ebooks about ghosts, hauntings, and all these mysteries that surround us. Again, I believe that there's much more that we don't understand than what we do understand.
Wow. Well, we look forward to seeing them. Our time is up, David, but thank you so much for joining us, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Happy Halloween, and happy Dia de los Muertos to everyone out there.
Again, for more information on David J. Schmidt and his work, please visit his website at holyghoststories.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, A.K. Jules. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.